I believe we're live. No, the page isn't. I think we're live with Rick Vito. I don't know. It's telling me mixed things, but I think we're live. Hi, Rick. How are you?
Hi, Vicky. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for doing this all the way from, okay, somewhere in Tennessee you are.
Franklin, Tennessee.
And how long have you been there?
I've been here since 1995. We moved
Oh, that's a
out.
long time.
Yeah, 95.
And has that been
So
a
we're
good thing?
practically native.
You are practically natives. Has that been a good thing for you?
It is. At one point, we thought we would move to Hawaii, and we moved there for a school year with my daughter. But it was that year that real estate and everything tanked, and so the house didn't sell, and we were very happy because we found that we didn't really. Well, it was more of a case of missing this place. So we came back, and we moved back from Hawaii, which doesn't seem possible, but that's what happened with us. But we like it here.
Well, so what's your, did you see the eclipse? And could you see the eclipse in Tennessee?
Yes, it got real dark here.
It got
Yeah.
really deep. We didn't
Yeah.
have the glasses. We watched it on CNN. I don't know.
Yeah, I wasn't that interested, to be honest.
So what is life? What was your the people that watch this show were the COVID crazies. What was your life like during the pandemic, the meat of the pandemic? What were you doing when sort of the lights went out, as it were?
Started out that year with Mick doing this tribute concert to Peter Green at the London Palladium. So I got to play with all these fantastic luminaries like David Gilmour and Bill Wyman from the Stones and Billy Gibbons and Christine McVie's last gig. It just went on and on. So I thought, oh, this is going to be the most incredible year. We're going to follow up. We're going to take this show on the road. And the pandemic hit. I got COVID at the after show party, came home to the States from London with it. And I
Get
guess,
out of
you
here. You
know,
got it at that first. Was it
yes.
bad? Was it bad?
No, it's like having a bad, you know, like a nasty flu, which I think most of the people
Jackson had it
felt.
at the very first go round also. He was doing a show at the Beacon, and I saw him like 3 days before he got sick. And so it wasn't bad for you. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, most of the people that I know, including my daughter who got it and my wife, you know, hold up was like having a bad flu and just a lot of liquids. And they were sending people home if you went to the hospital saying, oh, I have COVID. They're going, well, just go home and lots of bed rest and liquids and all. So, I mean, I didn't freak out about it. I got my natural immunity built up. And then I spent the next couple of years playing a lot of guitar, recording a lot of stuff in my studio. Doing a couple of local gigs and just kind of biding my time.
So you stayed productive. Did you enjoy more leisure time as well?
Yes.
You did.
Yes, I did. I did. I was ready to go on the road, but the fact that I didn't have to go on the road also was pretty good. I liked that. So it allowed me to, you know, put all that time into making a record that I was really satisfied with and happy with. And so I got a lot of stuff in the can that I wound up not using, but for future things, I have it already.
Well, I have to say that I've been loving Cadillac Man, and I don't know if that's the album, that absolutely loving it, playing it a lot. And you have a lot of like real blue, there's a lot of R&B in there, like really, which is kind of where I live. I love that stuff. I mean, you have some great rock and roll in there. There's a lot of like Chuck Berry kind of feeling stuff, Cadillac Man
Yeah.
itself, but sliding into blue and just into the day. Yeah, I've really been enjoying it. And
Thank you.
so I know very little Kenneth Reber. I have to say thank you. It's because of him that you're here. He kind of introduced me. You know, East Coast, West Coast, there's kind of this divide. Even though you started out on the, didn't aren't you from
Philly.
You're from Philly. You're a back. So how? All right. So you're a little kid. You're in Philly. Are your parents musicians? How do you get started playing?
You know, my mother, when she was a girl in the 30s, played the Hawaiian guitar in an all-girl Hawaiian band, you know, when she was a
In
kid,
an
and they played all the
all-girl
other.
Hawaiian band.
Yeah, Hawaiian music was real popular then. So my
Where?
grandfather
In Philly?
in Philly, yeah. Well, it was they played on the radio a few times, and she wanted to play piano, but they had no money or place to put a piano. So they got this little Hawaiian acoustic lap guitar, and my grandfather brought it over, and I started banging on it. And this was when rock and roll was just starting. So they saw my interest in it, and I got my own guitar and lessons and stuff, and just kept at it through that from that point on.
And so, were you like a protege? Did it like come to you right away? Were you like brilliant at it from the get-go? Did you have to work hard at it? Is it something you played all day, every day? Did you sleep with your guitar, or was it something that came easy to you?
Well, you know, I used to listen to people like Duane Eddy and Chuck Berry and just wish and try to play it. And at first, it was really hard. And I had an epiphany one day. Went over to somebody's a friend of mine's father had a like a what they call a hoagie shop, and they had a jukebox in there, and the kids would dance and all. And there was a girl in there playing the song "Summertime" on the acoustic guitar, and she was singing and playing. And I watched her, and she showed me, well, this is how the chords go with the melody of the song. And I learned that. And all of a sudden, a light bulb went on, and I realized, oh, that's how you play along to songs and all. That's how it works. And from that point, I never put it down. I just played by ear and picked it up and learned songs from the radio, et cetera.
And so, is it true that what I heard that you don't read music?
Right.
Neither does Snuffy. This is very interesting to me that musicians can be as successful as you guys are and not read music. And yet, you've done sessions.
Oh, many, many.
Like, how does that? So, how do you do that? How do you do that?
Oh, well, it's really simple. Usually, like you've heard of the Wrecking Crew, the
Hell
guys that did
yes.
all the, you know, Beach Boys, Tip Frank Sinatra, et
Of
cetera. Well,
course.
they had part of those guys like Teddy Tedesco, who were the reading guys.
Right.
And then they bring in guys like James Burton or Glen Campbell, who did not read for this, for the just because they could make up stuff. They had a facility for that. And that's what I have. That's it's a gift, you know, it's a blessing. I can just make stuff up. And that fits, that makes the record sort of had a little extra, you know, feel or whatever, just the different level of creativity comes out.
So I also heard you say that, which I loved. I have this problem with shredders. I just there's a lot of guitar players that get a lot of love that do absolutely nothing for me because it just feels like all they're doing is gymnastics on the neck, and it's to me extremely boring. And I heard you say, I think you say it, but it's about playing less and. You say it. What you think makes a good guitar player. Do you
Well,
know what I'm
yeah,
talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about. I was just watching. Somebody sent me a video. They're always sending me, watch this kid. Look at this, what this kid can do, you know? I'm going, yeah, okay. Yeah, I get it. You know, he's watched a lot of videos and had a lot of tutorials and the whole thing. But the feel's not there. And when I was younger, there were certain players who I just loved. I loved B.B. King and Freddie King and Albert King, and they didn't play a lot of crazy notes. And I loved Peter Green, and he didn't play a lot of crazy notes. And Mike Bloomfield and all these guys appealed to me. And it was Amos Garrett's another one that comes to mind. These guys didn't play fast, shreddy stuff. They played with feeling and soul. And I thought, well, that's where I want to live as a musician. You know, let the other guys have that. They'll do their thing. And it's crowd-pleasing stuff. You know, it really is. People love to see that. I mean, you know, let's face it, they like it. And there's
Because
enough
when you
guys
make
that do
people
that really
feel,
well.
When you make, oh wait, what are you talking about crowd pleasing? When you're shredding or when you're making people feel?
When you're shredding, the
Oh,
shredders go over
yeah.
really well with the crowds, you know. It's,
Right,
it's
right.
and so I'm not taking anything away from them. That's their thing. It's just not my thing. I prefer to go the other route, the less is more route.
Right. And so when you started and you're a kid, so you're listening to those incredible blues players, but
Yeah.
you came up in rock and roll. Who in rock and roll were you listening to?
Well, you know, like most people my age and from that era, Duane Eddy was real big. And I'm very happy to say, I can tell you this right now, that Duane has become a very good friend of mine. He lives nearby. But Duane
Wow.
was the first, and then Chuck Berry, The Ventures, and let's see, just anybody that came on television on Dick Clark that played guitar, I was really interested. That, you know, Elvis was a great rhythm player, and Scotty Moore behind him, and all these guys, Bo Diddley, and all that played guitar. I just was fascinated by it. I just couldn't get enough of that kind of thing. And then when the Stones came out, that really kind of it was a really great learning experience for me. There was something about the way Keith and Brian played that I related to, and I was able to learn from them and take it another level up from what they were doing. And so they helped me learn how to play Chuck Berry better, and how to listen to Muddy Waters and all these other people whose songs they recorded. It was just an education. Then I just would go from one blues guy or rockabilly guy or whatever from one to the next. It's like going to the class of B.B. King or the class of, you know, whomever.
I heard that rockabilly influence on Cadillac Man on your album. Definitely, there's that influence there. So, were you more so back in the 60s? It was like we were either Beatles or Stone. Like people either leaned to the Beatles or the Stones. So you leaned more to the Stones. That was more your
Absolutely.
net. That.
Absolutely. I was not into, you know, team sports, so I'd come home from school every day and put on those records and play till dinner time, you know. That's how I learned to really play.
Wow. Okay. And also, I heard you say I heard you talk about Hendrix, who for
Oh yeah.
me was the money. And I heard you say you got to see him play more than once.
Three times. And the first time I saw him, he wasn't famous yet, and he was playing with Little Richard.
Wow.
And the reason I knew it was him was because my brother and I both talked about the fact that, hey, did you see that guitar player who just took a Fender guitar and turned it around? He was playing this way, you know. And then I found out years later that he was with Little Richard. And so yeah, so and then just that was 65. Then I saw him in late 67. And oh my gosh, you know, you can't really watch videos of them and get the same feeling. You had to have been there. And,
I
you know,
wasn't there. I didn't
the
get to see
master.
him live. But
Can't even.
I can appreciate. I mean, you listen to Electric Ladyland, and how can you not
Yes.
appreciate what that is? You
Those first
just.
three records, you know, that's what I tell kids, you know, I said, you want to hear some guitar art? You want to hear something never was done before and really probably never was done since in an original sense. Here's a genius for you, you know, of rock and roll guitar. And you know, he had the experience and the road chops and the pain and the deprivation of whatever he had to go through to get where he got. You know, you don't get that at the Guitar Institute of Technology. You know, you got to live it. And he lived it, and that's why it's so great.
He's another one. He's one that put a lot of space between the note. Like he knew where to let the notes breathe and, you know, just let them. But we're talking about letting notes breathe and sing. That's another place. Stones, Beatles, it was also Beck, Clapton. And as much as I love Cream and I love Clapton, for me, it was Beck. And I got to see him just before he passed, and he was so brilliant. But he could just make a guitar sing like No one I have ever heard before, since, or probably ever will again. He could just make a note sing. How about you? Between the Clapton and the Beck, where did you fall in there?
Well, I guess I didn't really follow Jeff after Truth. I had the Truth album, and I really, really liked that. But I found that I didn't want to really listen too closely to any one person. So like found it that if I listened to too much Eric Clapton, I started playing like Eric Clapton, and that's not good. But Jeff Beck will say, I agree with you 100% that he was a genius. There was no one else like him. I think he was majorly inspired by the level of Hendrix to come up with
I
something
totally agree with
on
you.
his own to kind of get to that space where he was standing alone in the world. And I think he reached it. And I total admiration and respect for the guy.
Is there anybody like young and new that has caught your ear that when you hear them on the radio, you go, that person has their own sound, their own style? I like that.
I wish I could say there was, and I'm sure there's plenty of great young guys out there. I don't listen that often, number one. I'm caught up on my own world. And so, no, I can't answer that affirmatively, like I can point to one
Okay,
person.
so let's talk
But,
about you. So you're a kid, you're listening to all this great music, you're playing all this, you're playing. How do you get your how do you start? What's your first band? Whether
well,
you're
I was
making
playing.
money at it or not.
Yeah, I was playing semi-professionally in the latter part of high school and all through college. And
You're
I
still
guess
in
it's around,
you're still in Philly?
I'm right now I'm up in a college called Kutztown, which was
Okay.
near in way between Reading and Allentown, Pennsylvania. And we were listening to this record. Oh, a girl that I went to class with, she said, "Oh, I went to the Electric Factory and I saw this band that you would love." I said, "What is it?" She said it was Delaney and Bonnie and Friends with Eric Clapton playing with them. I said, "Really?" She was going on about this. So I got the record and I was listening to it. It was a live record. And I thought it was just great rock and roll and with all this blues and gospel influence. And it was just this great amalgamation of different musical forms. And I loved it. And then I found the record they had put out prior to that, which was called Accept No Substitute, which really was a record that turned LA on its heels at the time. The people that were on that record were like Leon Russell, Rita Coolidge, the guys that went into Derek and the Dominoes, Jim Keltner. It was just, and
Amazing
they
musicians.
influenced everybody, the Stones and the Beatles and all. They just, this was a major group at the time for a very short period of time. So when I saw that they were coming to town, I knew all their songs and I went and introduced myself to them. I got backstage and they were very nice and so they came back again and I went back again. The third time I went back to see them, they said, "Did you bring your guitar with you?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Why don't you sit in with us?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." And I sat in with them at Lehigh University, and it was one of those moments that kind of brought the house down and everything. You're
Wow.
like,
How old are you at this point?
I'm just about to turn 21, so I was 20. And
Wow.
after the show, they said, "Well, what are you going to do with this?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to be a professional musician, full time." They said, "Well, you got to come to LA." And they gave me their number. And they said, "When you finish school, you should go out to LA and call us and we'll try to help you get started." That's all I needed to
Wow.
hear. After that school year, I went out there and I called them. Actually, I had worked with Todd Rundgren in New York City during that year too. And Todd was living in LA.
Wait,
So,
how did that happen? How did you connect with Todd Rundgren?
through the guy I was working with, Ricky Valeni, we had a duo, like a blues kind of R&B. He played harmonica and I guitar, and he was friends with Todd and had been in a band with him in the Philly area. So he invited us to come to Electric Ladyland Studio in New
Wow.
York in first session. And we kept in touch. And the song from that session got on a James Cotton Blues Band album. That was the first credit I had. And
Wow.
living in LA, and he we had communicated, and I went up to his house and he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Man, I just came out to check it out and see what I could do, you know." So he said, "You're staying here." He gave me a place to live for like a couple of months. So while I got my feet
Wow.
wet and hired by Delaney and Bonnie and went on the road with them. So I mean, there were angels watching over me during that time period.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And then you ended up playing on a certain Todd Rundgren album, didn't you?
It was called Something Anything.
Oh my God. That
My
was
first
my
credit.
whole freshman year of college. That's all that was on the turntable. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right.
That's amazing. That's cool. Your
Yeah, it
credits are
was.
extraordinary. Okay, so you play with Delaney and Bonnie, and what happens out, and so and that had to be an extraordinary experience, I assume. What a
Oh, yeah. And people are always coming and sitting in with them. Like, I got to play with King Curtis, Duane Allman,
my God.
John Hammond Jr., who else? Mitch Mitchell. I mean, it just, it was just
With Mitch
wonderful.
Mitchell. So you came one degree from
One degree, yeah, from Jimmy, who was gone at
Wow.
that time already. But yeah, and then I just networked. I was living in Los Angeles. It was the place to be. This was the early 70s. I got to work with Leon and Rita Coolidge and Bobby Whitlock, a lot of these people that had been with Delaney and Bonnie, and eventually worked with John Mayall. That was kind of
Okay,
a
so
great
how did that? I saw
opportunity.
John Mayall at the Fillmore East in New York in like 1971 or something. Before you played with him, I guess.
Yeah.
It was USA Union, that album. So and you
Yes.
did three albums with John. So
Yes.
how did you make that connection? How did that happen for you?
That happened through a great friend of mine who has since passed away, named Larry Taylor. Larry Taylor was the bassist in
And
Can He
he.
and the Mole. And he was a great guy, just a funny guy, just a wonderful musician. And he called me and he said, "Hey, I told John about you and he's looking for a guitar player, do you want to go up to his house?" "Count me in." So we went up to his house in Laurel Canyon and played two or three numbers, and he puts his guitar down and he said, "Well, if you want the gig, you're in." I said, "Yes, sir, please, I'll take it."
Wow.
And then a month later, we were in the studio, and a month after that, we were getting ready to go on the road. That's how fast John worked.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It sounds like you were a good little networker, but like you have good social skills.
Well,
You
at the time, I
do.
thought I felt like I was, pretty shy, but the fact of the matter was that there was just something about being there at that time in that place. And, I met a lot of nice people. A lot of my friends turned me on to this or that. And I was able to, have a little bit of a chameleon-like quality. I can shift styles and think of things to play that complements the artist I was working with at the time. And then I was trying to write songs and be a stand on my own 2 feet at the same time, which is much harder to do.
Okay, so when did you start doing that?
In the 70s,
You
mid
so
70s.
all along while you were playing with
Yes.
these other people, you were working on your own stuff as well.
Yes. It wasn't always good, but I was working towards something.
And did you get close?
Yes. Yeah, I did my first full album in 1977, but it didn't get picked up. It was some good things on it, but looking back on it was probably a good thing.
And would you get these people that you were playing with to come and play with you on your albums?
To some extent, but I've never been one to really do that. It probably would be a good idea for the next record if there is one. to, call a few of my friends up and have them guest appear.
So you're a good networker when it's to their benefit, but maybe not so much to aid yourself when it's
Well,
just, you know.
Stevie Nicks appeared on my first solo album that was released on Modern Atlantic called King of Hearts. And actually, they offered us, we could have done a duo album because I was just
Wow.
coming out at the time. And part of me wishes I had done that because it would have been a very interesting, certainly more well-known CD album than my record turned out to be, but it still was a great record, and the numbers that she appeared on really hold up well, I think. I think it was one of those things that just got, not really heard as much as it should have.
Why didn't you do the do it as a do because you had your own vision for it, you decided to follow your original vision?
I suppose I don't know. We probably should have talked it through more. I don't know.
And so how did the whole Fleetwood Mac thing? I mean, that's just crazy. How did the whole Fleetwood, because you weren't a hired gun, you were part of Fleetwood Mac. How did that happen?
Yeah, that happened just again, and one of those things, I'd known Billy Burnett for years, and Billy, every time I saw Billy, he'd say, "Man, I love the way that you play. I got to get you on one of my songs," blah blah blah. So I went over a friend, dear friend's mutual friend, John Herron's house, great keyboard player, and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm on my way to Billy's session." He said, "Mick's going to play drums." I said, "Really?" I said, "Let me call Billy on the phone." So I got Billy on the phone. I said, "Billy, John's coming over to do your session. You're always saying I ought to get on your record. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to play for free if you'd like to have me on your record, and I'll come over." He said, "Are you kidding? Come on over." So I went over and hung out with Mick, and we talked about the old Peter Green days, which was a big, 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 big influence on me, and he liked that. And I think maybe it was a month or two later, Billy and I again were working on a Roy Orbison record. Billy had written a song, and I was playing the lead guitar on. And we got a call. Well, Billy got a call first from Mick, and then I got a call a couple days later, seeing if I, this was after Lindsay had left. And he said, "Do you want to come learn 10 or 12 songs and come and play with us?" And I said, "Yeah, yes, sir." So he sent some songs over to learn, and I learned them and went down and played. And that was it. Again, at the end of the day, he said, "Well, you guys are in if you want it." And we did. And
And so, how did that become not just being a hired gun, but actually becoming part of the band?
well, because that's the way they wanted it. They didn't want to go out as the four original members and hired people. They wanted to keep on. Their tradition was to change members. I mean, they started off with four, they went to five, then they went to, I think, six with Bob Welch. And they had two various singers come in and out of the fold, and then Stevie and Lindsey came. So it was a tradition for them to change members. And I think they just wanted to keep that going and not just rest on their laurels.
And so what was that like for you to like walk into this huge, successful stadium arena, screaming fans who know every word to every song band? What was that like when you hit the stage with them and you're now part of this machine?
Right. It seems like it would have been totally intimidating and frightfully just intimidating. The fact of the matter was, I had just come on about a year's tour with Bob Seger. So I'd just come off a year of screaming fans in the biggest stadiums in the country. And I was well prepared. My chops were up. It didn't faze me like it might have at another time in my career, perhaps. But it just was, it was relatively easy for me to just learn the songs and step in there. And they were nice people. I liked them all. I got along well, and it just kind of they took a long, long time to prepare for the tour. So I didn't feel like, oh, we're going to rush this right out. We had at least a month or 5 weeks of rehearsal, and then tried a couple of practice shows, and they went over well. So then we went out, and it worked out well.
And so you're married 41 years, which, as we were
Yes.
discussing earlier, in rock and roll, that's like, I don't even know. That's like a 700 years. I don't know. That's a lot of years. How on earth did you, and you have two kids, grown
Yeah.
children, how did you manage to do this life on the road and have this successful marriage? And how did you juggle this lifestyle?
Well,
And you didn't have FaceTime then. I would imagine now it's much easier with FaceTime, right?
would imagine so. Yeah, I would imagine so. Yeah, that part of it, being away from home, was rough. But most of the time, I wouldn't be out for more than maybe 3 or 4 weeks max, and then we'd get a little break. But to answer your question, I had plenty of time where I was with the wrong person, or just, was a bachelor. And when I met my wife, I knew she was the right one for me, and I made the decision, okay, I'm going to grow up now. Now's the time. I've had plenty of time to do what I did, and now's the time to not mess this up. And I made the commitment, and of course, she also threatened to kill me if I ever did. So the fear of that had a little bit to do with it. But no, she's just a wonderful woman. She's not into being into show business or hanging out with show business people, and that balanced myself out quite well. So
Did your
that was.
family ever come out and visit you on the road, or was that not
Yes.
like a they did?
Yes. That was, we went to Europe several times, and Australia, and of course the various places on the road. They would come out if I couldn't get home. That's how we'd work it.
Okay, so let's backpedal to Bob Seger. How did that, I mean, like a rock, how the hell did that come to be for you? Because to this day, arguably, maybe the most iconic slide guitar playing that exists on a recording. And I'm a slide guitarist. I just love slide guitar. And
Oh,
then,
yeah.
and the, I can't, did you get to, did you and Bonnie go mano a mano
So,
with the slide guitar? Oh my God, I
a
can't
little
even.
bit. A
Whew.
little bit. I was working with her. She did want me to do it on a couple of songs, where we kind of dueled back and forth, but I was very careful. Her being such a great stylist and being known as a slide guitar player, I didn't want to come into that situation and upstage that or in any way, So anyway, the Seeger thing came about as a result of having worked with Jackson Browne, and a guy that I know, Russ Kunkel,
Yeah.
recommended me to Bob because they were looking for somebody to play on a couple of songs he had. And I went to the studio and met Bob, and he put up this kind of mid-tempo, slow-moving song with these big, long passages that didn't have any solo on it. And I said, "Well, what are you thinking?" And he said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "Well, I'd like to try a slide guitar on that."
So that was
And
your idea.
he said, "No, I really don't like slide guitar that much." I said, "Well,
Wow.
give me one pass. And let's see, if it doesn't work, we'll move on to another idea." And so luckily enough, I got the whole song, the first solo and the back solo on the first pass. The only thing we had to overdub was the ending two chords of the song because I didn't know where it ended. So just
Wow.
on that part of your brain where you're connecting with your creative self, and it worked. We tried a
Wow.
few times after that, and it didn't work as well. They got it on. Luckily, he had the button pressed and caught it.
Did he know as soon as he heard it the first time? Oh gosh, he was right. Yeah, this is, yeah, it
Yeah.
was magic. He knew, he heard
Yeah.
the magic.
Yeah, it was the combination of the sound and the song, and I guess what I played, and it just worked. It all worked.
So speaking of Bonnie, how did that come about for you, rolling backwards?
Let's see, I played with her several times. The first time I subbed for her regular guitar player, Will McFarlane, whose wife was having twin kids. And so I did a tour. The opening act was Muddy Waters. Can you believe that? And so then when the chair came up again a couple of years later, I was invited to audition, and I got it. And then again, ran into her in 98, and she was changing a couple of members then. And she came to, I was playing at B.B. King's up in Universal Studio. Yeah, Universal. And she sat in and offered me the gig again. So just, we just knew a lot of the same people.
And so from Bonnie, that led you to Jackson, which
Yeah.
we were talking before we went on the air about that video of you with Russ and Cooch. And oh my God, you were such
Somebody made
babies.
me all
It's,
that.
I mean, Jackson, I mean, I remember when he looked that like that. Oh my, I just saw him a few weeks ago. I mean, we've all grown up quite a bit since then, but you were babies. My
Yeah,
God.
we all pretty young in
So
those
how did you
videos.
go from Bonnie to Jackson? Because you did quite a bit of work with Jackson.
Yeah, well, I had had worked with Jackson on this record by a friend of his that he was producing called Greg Copeland, and David Lindley had left to do this solo record, which was amazing, El Rayo X, or El Rayo X. And so he needed somebody to come in, and Bonnie was again going in a different direction with a different producer and the band that the producer brought in. So, which was cool, she was always been like that to change her direction and keep things fresh and such. So Jackson offered me the gig, and it was perfect timing. Stepped right into that, and we worked together for a couple of years.
It was fun to watch you and Cooch kind of trading off.
Yeah, we had three guitarists. Jackson's always been a great rhythm guitar player, and Cooch was writing with Jackson. So a lot of the tunes we were doing were co-writes, Cooch and Jackson. And so and then Cooch left to go with Don Henley because he had written some of those big hits that Don had. And then it was just Jackson and I for about another year after that.
And did you, Rick, do you always, I get the sense that you leave things on good terms. You seem the type that leave people on good terms.
Yeah, I'm still friends with everybody that I've ever worked with, as far
I
as I
get
know.
that. I get that feeling. And I
Far
heard
as
a, as far as you
from
know,
my
although
perspective.
I heard Jackson talking about, no, I'm kidding. I did. So I heard a very cute story about how you met John Fogerty, which I have a little. So tell us how you met John Fogerty.
My son was going to a school up on Mulholland, I forget the name of it, when we still lived in Los Angeles. And one of the kids in his class was John's stepdaughter. And so at one point every year, the school had a weekend where the parents would come and help fix the school up. And it was a big campus. It was like a college, really. And so they assigned me to paint this one building with this other guy. So I go over there with my roller, and there's a guy painting the building. It's John. So John and I painted the school building together.
Unbelievable.
And every year, John would do a concert for the kids. And he asked me if I
Oh.
would play with him. And I played with him. And I swear, I've done a lot of shows with John, but that was the best show, the most fun
Oh,
I ever saw him have in a for
wow.
the school. And then after that, I went on tour with him for about a year, opening for Tina Turner over in Europe, and a lot of good.
Wow, that's crazy. What was that
Yeah,
like?
big, giant, giant,
Wow.
screaming European fans who love Tina Turner.
What was Tina like?
You didn't get close to Tina. She had bodyguards all around her all the time, and you didn't see her much. She would just appear and then go on stage, and then disappear.
I wonder which kid of John's it was when my daughter was auditioning for UCLA for the drama musical theater department. One of his kids was auditioning and he was there that whole 2 day process and he was over there. We were just kind of from afar
Okay. Well,
going through the
this little
process.
girl, stepdaughter. So, and then he and his wife had two sons, I believe, together after that.
That's
So
probably
there
what it
were
was. My
children.
daughter's 26, so it was probably from the
One
second.
of the boys, yeah.
That's, and so I also saw on your credits, I haven't heard you talk about him, but one of my heroes, John Prine. Tell me about that.
Well, I talked earlier about working with this guy, Bobby Whitlock, who was the keyboard player in Derek and the Dominoes. And I was only 22 or something, and we were on tour with his first solo album. It was one of my first tour road gigs. And we played Max's Kansas City. You remember
Oh
that, I'm
my
sure.
hell yeah.
So at the gig was Steve Cropper, who was a longtime friend of Bobby's, both being from Memphis. And he liked what I was doing, and he asked me if he could, take my number and call me sometime for session work. Well, 2 years later, I get the call from Cropper saying, "I'm producing John Prine. Have you heard of him?" I said, "Yeah, I've heard he's like, extremely great lyricist and, up and coming great
But
songwriter."
lyricists were not your thing, from what I've heard you say, right?
Pardon?
Lyricists were not your thing, from what I've heard you say.
Well, I've always listened to the guitar and the feel of the record before the lyrics first. That's why I'm way more into Chuck Berry than I am Bob Dylan. And always will be. Not to take anything away from Bob Dylan, he's a genius, of course. But yeah, I listened to that element of that. Yeah. So anyway, he flew me to Memphis, and we did the Common Sense album with
Oh
John.
my
Great
God,
guy.
that's like the best album.
Oh, thank you. There was a
Oh
lot
my.
of people on that record. Steve Goodman, Bonnie Raitt, the
Steve
Eagles
Goodman,
were
I
on it.
saw Steve Goodman and John Prine together at Carnegie Hall. Oh my God. Yeah,
Yeah, they were
amazing.
fantastic together. They were great friends, and they understood each other.
They
They really
certainly did. Except, I saw John back then and spoke to him back then, and he was amazing. And then I saw John again in the late 80s at the Ritz in New York, and it was a very different experience. He was kind of in the throes of his disease. I'm a sober woman. I understand that side of things, but that particular night wasn't one of his best. He was kind of loaded and it was kind of a drag. But I like to think of him like that night in the 70s when he was in his when Prine was in his prime. And
Prime. That's one of his records I'm actually on.
Amazing. That is so amazing.
He was definitely a special guy.
A very special. I can't believe the list of how about working with Leon Russell? Leon, oh my God. How about working with Leon?
Friend of mine, Marty Greb, again, who's sadly passed on, he was after me to work with Leon in 1 year in particular, and I was having a very difficult time for various reasons, and I couldn't do the couldn't do it. I couldn't go over and meet Leon and do this thing. So a year after that, he called me again. He said, "Leon would still like to meet you and have you come down and play." He was married to Mary Russell at the time, Leon and Mary, and so I went down, and he had this studio in Burbank, and the two set pianos set up facing each other and a band. And so I went and met him, and he just started playing, no charts, and wouldn't say what the name of the song was. You were just, you just played along, just, and he recorded everything. Then I'd get calls from him to come up to the house, and he lived in Toluca Lake, and went to his house, and he had this room, and he had about 16 televisions. This was before the day where, about a dozen at least televisions stacked up on each other, and he had this gizmo, and he flipped through the different stations and stuff. He was very much a techie.
Wow, that's crazy.
And we'd record at his home studio there again. I don't know what I recorded. There wouldn't be titles to these things, and he would just like have tracks. I don't know if anything was released. I just kept working with him because it was a creative thing, and he was a quirky, funny guy and just a genius, and I enjoyed his company. And after a while, it just, I don't know, something else came along. I think I had to go on the road or something, and I had to give it up.
How interesting.
It was interesting.
His Young Blood is like my favorite track on Bangladesh. It's like just classic,
Yeah, he
classic.
had a real commanding presence on stage, didn't he? I mean,
Oh yeah.
there again, he worked his way up. He was in the Wrecking Crew, and he was, did a million sessions, and he was working and honing his own craft all along. And when his time came, he was ready.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, so you spent what 4-ish years with Fleetwood Mac, and but
Yes,
you've
40.
continued to work with Mick Fleetwood. So why did how did your relationship with Fleetwood Mac end, and but you've continued to work with Mick all these years, yeah?
Yeah, well, towards the tail end of my time there was just talk within the band that maybe the girls were going to leave and do this or that and whatever. And it was sort of just, it sort of ran out of energy. And the record that we put out, I think it did great, but it didn't do what they usually do. And I think that there was some speculation about this or that. Anyway, it kind of folded up. Well, and we all went our separate ways. And that Fleetwood Mac went away for a long time. And I didn't see Mick for like a dozen years. And all of a sudden, he had gotten wind of this record I did with a mutual friend, Ian Wallace, great drummer friend of mine. And it was called Bandbox Boogie, and Mick heard it and he called me. He said, "Man, I love this record, and blah blah blah." And he said, "Would you ever want to like put together like a blues thing like back in the Peter Green era?" And I said, "Count me in." And he said, "I want to do that, and I also want to try some stuff in Hawaii with some of the local Hawaiian musicians. How would you feel about coming out there and trying that out?" I said, "Well, yeah, that sounds great." So we sort of just got back together and put together the Mick Fleetwood Blues Band featuring Rick Vito. I gave him credit, and we did a record live album, and it got nominated for a Grammy in
It's
2010.
certainly did.
Yeah, and so we did a lot of European touring, and the last thing we did, sadly, was that Peter Green concert, and then COVID hit, and we were going to start doing some more things recently, and you've heard about the tragic fires in Lahaina, and where his
We
club
were
were.
supposed to go to Maui a couple of months later.
Well, he lost his club, and so sadly those plans went up in smoke, sorry to pun. But so yeah, we're in touch. We talk with her, we have texts,
Talk about
but
who was at that, who played at that last concert you played at, though.
in the band, yeah, well, it was Mick and I were the core of it, because obviously we've been playing that music together for quite a long time. And then a guy called David Bronze on bass, Andy Fairweather Lowe, both who were in Clapton's bands. So they were very, very, very much versatile guys that could play with anybody. And so we had Johnny Lang and Billy Gibbons and Pete Townsend. Jeremy Spencer came out of retirement, I guess. Christine McVie came in for her last show, sadly. David Gilmour, and let's see, John Mayall.
Okay, so now let's stop a second and talk about Pete Townsend for a moment. A friend of mine, Lauren Gold, plays and has been playing with the Who for about a dozen years, and I've seen them a few times in the last, I don't know how many. I did not. I was always a Who fan, but I had never seen them live. And now I've seen them a few times. And I have to say that Pete has moved up in my ranks as one of the greatest guitar players of all time. He is, wow. He
He was a
takes my
great guitar player.
he takes my breath away. And
He
he like you talk about the guys that carve their niche as being completely original. He is a completely original, isn't he?
yeah, absolutely. Like you, I can remember listening to, my generation, and then I remember one of my roommates having The Who Sells Out. I listened to that a lot. I enjoyed that record, but I didn't really follow it. Once I got into Quadrophenia and all that stuff, it didn't move me. But when he came to the thing, first of all, everybody that came to that show, there was not any ego. These guys all came in because they
Wow.
loved Green and wanted to participate in this honoring of the man. And Pete was he was into the early Peter Green stuff too, and he came in and we did the song, and he played the heck out of his lead guitar, just one song, just killed it and left.
Yeah, that sounds like Pete. Okay, so let's talk about Cadillac Man. Let's talk about your album, which is in
Sure.
heavy rotation in the Snicky Mobile. We've been playing it a lot and
Thank
just
you.
really enjoying it. So you're doing a cover of it's 2 a.m., right? You do that on there, don't you?
Well,
Don't
it's not
you?
really a cover, but because I wrote
You
it.
wrote it. And
Yeah, that's
Shanique.
it. Yeah, Shemeika Copeland did. Another band had recorded a demo of the song years and
Wow, it's your song.
one of my songs. And I guess she heard that demo and put the song out much, much different arrangement. So I wanted to put the original arrangement that I had originally written the tune around. And so
Love
that's
the
my song.
song. And my friend Kevin Jenkins
Thank
has been
you.
playing with her for years and years. He's a bass player.
Oh, good.
I didn't know that was your song, and it's great, and I
Thank
love
you.
your version of it. It's wonderful. So,
Thank you.
okay, so what's the best way for Pete? I always ask this because there's like no way for you guys to make money on your music these days. What's the best way for
Yeah.
people to buy your music for you? For so that.
Well, it's available anywhere, but you can go to rickveto.com. You can go to Blue Heart Records.
So
It's
if they get it
available
like
anywhere.
on Spotify, though, you're not getting any money for, how can they?
Yeah, you want to stay away from those streaming places. Buy the record, and buy the whole record. I try to. I mean, when I buy somebody's record, I don't buy just one song unless it's like
Right.
a vintage song that I need to learn for some reason, or that I want to have it in my repertoire. But buy the album, support the artist.
Buy the album, support the artist. So I'm going to put the. Now, so is the best link I can give the link to your website so that they can go there and buy it there, or the
Yeah,
specific
you can do
link for
that.
your album? You tell me that you'll give me the best link for people to go to buy the album so they can buy the whole thing.
www.rickveto.com.
Okay, I'm going to give them that link in the liner notes so everybody can do that. Rick, thank you
Thank
so much for taking the time and doing this. It's been lovely getting to know you and your music.
Thank you
And
very much. Yeah. Mutual. Thank you very. I really enjoyed your questions, and I wish you the best with your continued success with your shows.
thank you so much, Rick. Have a wonderful rest of your day. And I look, so wait, are you going out on the road? Can people come hear you live? Are you playing live? What, tell us what.
I'm not going on the road right now for there's several reasons that contribute to that, but for now I'm just concentrating on the record. And I should mention, got this new guitar out, the
Can
Reverend.
people, all right, can
Called
people
Agent.
buy your guitars? We didn't talk about that. Show us your
Yeah,
guitar.
that's cool. ReverendGuitars.com. It's called the Rick Vito Soul Agent, and they're really great guitars. I'm not just saying that. Their quality control is impeccable, and they're just versatile, incredible workhorses.
Tell us
It looked good,
about that
pretty.
guitar. Tell us, it looks gorgeous, but as a guitar, what is it a what would you liken it to?
Well, the thing that we tried to do with this guitar, because I've been designing guitars for years, I have various prototypes made, but Reverend Guitars and I sort of combine our ideas. They being the more technical, and me being the more coming from the more design point. But one thing that I wanted to do was have a combination of tones that liken the sound of both Gibson and Fender, and a little Gretsch in there.
Wow.
So we have push-pull switches on the volume and tone that allow you to get various tonal increments of different sounds, and it's really very versatile and well made. I've played hundreds of these things, and I haven't come across a lemon yet. So
Fantastic. And it's
that's
a
kind of
great
what.
looking thing too.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much again, Rick. Have a wonderful rest of your day and hope to see you again soon.
Okay, we'll see you out there in LA someday.
Excellent. Take care. Bye-bye.